Working Cows Podcast, episode 125.
Welcome to the podcast that gives producers a platform to discuss and share paradigm-challenging practices. Practices that have increased the effectiveness of their operation and the joy that their families have received from this lifestyle.
Howdy, everybody. It's Clay Connery, host of the Working Cows Podcast, powered by the Global Ag Network, coming to you live from a Canadian hotel room, recording this intro to this podcast I did with Cooper Hibbard, from my Canadian hotel room. So I really appreciate the opportunity to come up here, and I've got a lot of things to share about the experience of being up here. A really great experience, great people. Organic Canada and Holistic Management Canada put on a great conference, lots of great people providing practical knowledge and wisdom and tools to make everybody's farms and ranches better. So, but that's coming up, probably episode 128 will be a look at that, so a couple weeks out. Got some other good things coming up in the future. I'll talk about it after the episode. Cooper Hibbard is a member of Sieben Livestock, and that's a multi-generational ranch, and they are working on improving land and resources with cattle, and they're working on making sure that their ranch is sustainable for generations to come as it has been for generations previous. So I'm really excited to be joined by Cooper. Got connected with him through Johan Zietzman's texting group, and was also recommended by Logan Pribino. So, Cooper, thanks for joining me today on the Working Cows Podcast.
Honored to be here with you, Clay. Thanks for having me.
You came up a while back on the Working Cows Podcast, and long before that, I had you as a suggested guest from other individuals. I think Logan Pribino might have been the first one, and then Graham Reese mentioned you, that they had spent some time with you guys on the Aussie Grazers Tour of the USA 2019, and so I reached out to you, and we've got her coordinated now. I'm really excited to have you here, and really would like to start off with a discussion of kind of the environment that you find yourself in there near Cascade, Montana, Adel, Montana. What is the nature of the surrounding terrain and kind of weather and resource base that you guys are entrusted with?
Well, we're in a pretty tough climate. We're in west central Montana, just on the east side of the Rockies. We're right in the foothills of the Big Belt Mountains, and we go from about 4,200 feet up to 7,800 feet, and the heart of the ranch is right at a mile high. And so that fluctuation in terrain and where we're located in the state can make for some pretty challenging circumstances. And so because of that, the ranch is basically divvied up into three different zones. We've got our summer country, which is the majority of the ranch. We're kind of like an inverse pyramid. The summer country would be the top strata of the ranch, and then below that would be the shoulder country and transition zone. And then at the very bottom, the tip of the pyramid, would be our winter country. And that's about how, acreage-wise, that's about how it split up, too. Mm-hmm. And so that has caused some unique challenges, historically speaking. So we can get, just like a lot of people in this part of the country, we can get some freak snowstorms. It can snow 4 feet of snow, it can snow 4 feet. I've seen that happen in a night. It can get to 45 below or 60 below with wind chill. And we don't really, since our winter grazing is the bottom point of that pyramid, that we don't have that much ground to go to with all of our cattle. And so when we get stuff like that, we're stuck. We don't really have much lower ground to go to. And so we've had to get fairly creative as far as how to match our resource base with our cow's production cycle. And just to kind of paint the picture a little bit more of what our resource base is like, it's phenomenal grass country. But our growing season is 90 days at best. We're at the headwaters of Hound Creek, which flows into the Smith River, which then flows into the Missouri River. And so there's water everywhere. We're just absolutely blessed with abundant grass and abundant water. I never knew that chopping ice was a thing until I went worked on a ranch in Colorado. And so that's kind of the world that I'd lived in. We're winter grazing all of our age cows, 4 years old and up, and have been for about 18 years or so, and that's had its own progression as far as where we were and where we are today. But one of the things that allows us to winter graze our cattle in this tough environment is we are in the what's called the Chinook zone, so we can get these warm winter winds that can cause a really fast melt. And if we don't get an actual Chinook, the wind is always blowing, so there's bare ground provided to us usually throughout the winter that we can graze our cows on. And how we've been grazing them, we can graze through 2 feet of snow if it's not crusted over, you know, or even if it is crusted over slightly and we graze them in a high enough density, they can break that crust up and get to the grass beneath. Also in our environment, it's all cool season. Nobody really knows of a warm season up here.
Same.
Yeah. But the beauty of that is these rough fescues, and Idaho fescues, they'll keep their green until March or April of the year. And so our cow's diet will be 5 to 7% protein throughout the winter grazing if we aren't supplementing them.
Mm-hmm.
It can be if we have a good fall green up.
Sure. So here's the direction I would like to go. It's 5 below 0 outside right now with a little bit of a breeze. So I want to start in summer grazing. you're grazing in your summer ground. You're up in the higher part. You said somewhere around 7,000, 7,800 feet, something like that, right?
That would be the very highest. Yeah. Right. The summer zone probably starts at 5,700 feet.
Mm-hmm.
It's 5. Yep.
Sure. And what kind of grazing are you doing there? Are you selectively grazing? Are they in large open paddocks with freedom to choose? How are you handling them?
So we calve June 10th, which is an anomaly for this part of the country. And
I'd say it's an anomaly for this hemisphere. Sorry.
yeah. Well, especially for this part of the country. When we first made that change from February to March calving to late spring, early summer calving, we jumped to May. But that just didn't work for us for two reasons. One, the grass wasn't quite ready yet. And two, because of how the ranch is structured, that winter grazing ground up to summer grazing ground, the grass isn't quite ready in our summer grazing ground until, well, early June, but we can be there May 25th or so. But it's about 12 miles that we'd have to trail those baby pairs. And so now what we're doing is we're calving June 10th up in the mountains in summer country. And so those first, as we're getting up there, let's say it's late May and the grass is coming on, we'll be in pretty tight paddocks. There'll be 1,250 head and anywhere from a 90-acre graze to a 250-acre graze, depending on what the terrain is. And then once calving starts in, then we lighten up on the density a little bit. We'll still be between 120 to biggest paddock that time of year would be 450 acres probably. And again, that's terrain and water and workload logistics and everything like that. But what we do is it's just kind of a try and do non-selective grazing as much as we possibly can without compromising our cow's performance at that time of the year, and also giving them enough space to calve and develop that mothering instinct. And when we go to move from one paddock to another, we'll go out and we'll just open up the poly wire, and this is typically on horseback, and we'll just start our cows moving through from the lead, and we won't ever really even go to the back. We'll just start them from the lead, and we'll leave that poly wire open for 2-3 days and just kind of catch up those baby pairs as time permits, and we just kind of keep migrating across the summer country as our grazing plan has stretched out for that time. Does that kind of paint the picture for what summer grazing?
Yes. Yep. And I got a few follow-up questions there. I guess the first one would be, is the hot wire, is that what's limiting their mobility for you guys?
Right. Yeah. So we'll string up, poly wire. And right now, one of our focuses is putting in some single strand high tensile fences, just kind of backbone fences to pull our poly wire off of. Mm-hmm. But most all of our fencing is done with poly wire. So it'll be, these grazes during calving will be anywhere from 3 days to longest might be, I suppose the longest is a 10-day graze, really through the thick of calving, and 10-day graze meaning cows are in there for 10 days, but they might have, majority of them would have gotten moved out at day 7 or something like that. But between all of our management groups at any given point, we may have 14 to 20 miles of poly wire up during the summer months.
One definition of overgrazing is grazing the same spot year after year. And so how are you guys managing that when you have your ranch broke up into, or grazing one spot year after year at the same time of the year? How are you guys managing that when you have the ranch broke up into zones, you know, summer transition, winter? How are you guys managing overgrazing in that scenario?
So we've been adhering to the Gus Hormé rest rotation system since the 1980s. And what that is, let's say in year one, you go into a pasture and you graze it during the growing season. Then in year two, you would go into that pasture and graze it post-seed ripe, so after July 15th or so. And then year three would be a full year of rest. Hmm. So what we've done is we've taken this high-density, short-duration, non-selective grazing and superimpose it on that rest rotation system. And so where we're going to be this June and July of 2020, we will not be there until probably August or September of 2021, and then 2022, they won't see me at all. And so that applies to our summer country as well as our shoulder transitional country. Our winter grazing ground, basically what we're doing there is most all of that grazing is happening during the dormant season. But where we are during the growing season, which should just be on the front end of the growing season, we'll be down there until about May 15th. But where we are from about April 5th to May 15th, we won't go back there during the growing season for probably another 4 years. We'll go back and graze it, but not during the growing season for another 4 years. So it won't be actively grazed while it's trying to grow.
So you are doing some fairly high-density grazing in difficult terrain during the summer months. Can you talk about how you are, what are the challenges that presents, and then how are you overcoming those challenges?
The challenges that presents, terrain-wise, we run in some pretty rough country, and so you have to get fairly creative with how we string up our fences with our poly wire. You know, as I mentioned, we do have water everywhere, and so part of the success of making that happen is how we fence our waters in, or our watering area in, to where we aren't completely nuking the riparian area. And so there's kind of a fine balance point that we have to strike to where we give them enough space in the riparian area to come down and get a drink, for a lot of cows to come down and get a drink at the same time. But we don't give them enough space to where it's comfortable. And so once we started doing that, the cow's behavior is they come down and they get a drink and then they trail back up another 1,000 feet, basically. They can, most drastic scenario, to go back and find that's where they bedded their calf down and go back to grazing and nursing. And so that's kind of what we've done. There's a balance point between the density that we needed at the water point to kind of disincentivize loafing and incentivize them to climb to these higher parts of the ranch and graze where we've never been able to get cattle to graze before. And once that behavior started to get ingrained, so that would have been probably that would have started probably 7 years ago. Once that behavior started getting ingrained in our cattle, we've had to get less and less stringent about how we fence in our watering areas, because it's now kind of ingrained in them to come down and just get a drink of water and get out. So that would be one challenge. The other is it's just a much more technical game. Once you start grazing cattle, higher density, shorter duration grazes, you've really got to be on the ball. And what our rule of thumb is, we try and move them sooner rather than later. We want to move our cows before it's even a thought in their mind that they're starting to become discontent or that they're needing more. We like to move them before that even starts, because the reason it's technical is that when the grass leaves or becomes fouled or it's time to go, it happens right now. That's been a learning curve for us, and we've learned through time that it's just, and that rule of thumb applies to whether we're grazing in the summer or grazing in the winter. It's just, we want to move our cows before it's even a flicker of a thought in their mind. And that just helps so much with behavior. It helps with keeping their nutritional plane where it needs to be and their body condition on maintaining or climbing, hopefully. And the grazing responses that we've seen from that, or the regrowth responses, have been exhilarating. Just been absolutely amazing what we've been able to accomplish from an ecological standpoint with grazing our cattle like this. And it's also given us much more control, and in some ways has become less work than our shorter duration grazes. Are of course, there's the threshold there, but they can become less work than the longer duration grazes, less poly wire. You do have more control. They're less apt to test the fence. You know, it's like the longer they stay in the grazes, the more they'll be willing to test the fence. We deal with a lot of wildlife. That would be another challenge. You know, there's a herd of elk in this whole area that's about 4,500 head. So when they come through, they've gotten used to looking out for poly wire. But if a wolf has gotten into them, or if it's hunting season, they will just completely wipe our poly wire out.
Yeah.
So that's a huge challenge. So we haven't quite been able to, I don't know if there's any answer to that.
Right.
We certainly haven't found one. The other challenge is nutrition, and that's whether we're grazing this way or not. That's more of a function of when we're calving. Like calving June 10th, our breeding season is September and October, and that's when peak lactation, it would be mid-August, and then breeding season in September and October, and all of our grasses are pretty well starting to lignify, you know, late July, early August. And so that's something that people don't really talk about when they talk about moving their calving dates. Or at least we certainly didn't hear about that as being a challenge, but it's a definite challenge for us. So that's something that we've been really trying to crack that nut as far as how to do that and not break the bank trying to get breed up to where it needs to be.
Yeah, I talked to Dave Olala, and you know, just in the course of trying to plan my ranching business, and said, you know, I'd like to calve in late May, or I'd like to lamb in late May, early June, and he said, you need to turn bucks out sometime at least a week or two before Christmas, because their fertility drops off so radically from Christmas to New Year's that it's really tough to get a good breed up on stuff like that. So it's always a, you know, some of these things, you get your head in a paradigm, and it's you just think that's the answer, but there's a few other strings connected to that piece of the.
It's always trade-off.
Yeah, yep. Sure. So first of all, I want to get to the improvements you guys have seen through this style of grazing, but I want to ask you if you could just briefly lay out the history of grazing at Sebin Livestock. What has been the history when you made some of these changes, and how have you continued to change throughout the history?
You bet. So I think I can't really speak to what grazing practices were before the 1980s. I'm sure it was pretty darn conventional. And all the way up until the 1950s or 60s, we're mostly a sheep ranch. And the height of it, through both world wars, there was probably 12 bands of sheep on the ranch. And then in the 1950s, 1960s, we transitioned to mostly cattle. We still do have some sheep. And then, sure, it was conventional grazing.
Mm-hmm.
And then starting in the 1980s, my uncle Chase implemented the Gus Hormé restoration system that I described earlier with the three-year scenario. And so that's how grazing has been happening or happened from 1980s until probably 2010. And then we became more influenced by holistic management. And then there was, well, to back up, actually starting about 2006, we started using a lot more polywire. And that's when holistic management started to take a hold in everyone's minds here on Stephen Livestock, and we started moving more quickly. And then 2010, that ramped up to where we were moving even more quickly, not necessarily tighter grazes, but it was more of selective grazing. And we continued on that path until 2014 or 15. I was exposed to Johann Zeitzman. I bought his book, and I read it multiple times. I was fortunate enough to listen to him talk a few times, and it just, what he's figured out just makes absolute sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
And so since then, we've transitioned from selective grazing, lower densities, to non-selective grazing when it makes sense, and much higher densities than we ever were before. So that's, in a nutshell, what the grazing transition has been like here, and we're still on the path of non-selective grazing when feasible, and
mm-hmm.
much higher density grazes. And what we've been seeing from that is anywhere from in our summer country, just because we aren't able to run the densities because of the cow's production, where we are in the cow's production cycle and the terrain and all of that, we're seeing an increase of forage harvest and efficiency and production rate of anywhere from 30 to 150%. And then in the winter grazing ground, it's anywhere from winter grazing, that's when we're doing daily moves, 1,000 cows on 15 acres kind of field.
Hmm.
We've seen anywhere from 60% to 485% increase forage harvest and production rate.
Wow. So, yeah, I guess that, are there any other improvements that you would like to talk about as a result of this transition in grazing, like increased species diversity and some of those things? Are any of those things been measured or something you're keeping an eye on?
We're certainly keeping an eye on it. We have 24 monitoring transects around the ranch, and where we have been implementing these much more severe grazing techniques, instead of rereading all of our monitoring transects, we read every 5 years. But instead of rereading it every 5 years, we'll reread every year, 2 years, 3 years to increase that feedback loop and really see what kind of an effect that we're having. And what we found is in that same time period that we've changed our grazing practices from a more selective grazing scenario to non-selective higher density, in a 5-year time span, we've decreased our bare soil from anywhere from, our worst case was, I believe it was 23% bare soil, and in 5 years that went down to 2%.
Mm-hmm.
In our most other cases, it was about 8% bare soil, and those, the next time we reread those transects, whether it was in a year or 3 years, it was all down to 0%.
Mm-hmm.
And those harvest rate increases, to highlight how significant those are, that happened in the driest period in the ranch's history. 5 driest consecutive years in the ranch's history, we increased our forage harvest and production rate on average, and our winter grazing ground was about double.
Jeez. That's incredible. Very cool. Very, very encouraging. Really appreciate that. Could you give a little bit of a brief overview of kind of the goals of the ranch from year to year? Maybe the top 3 goals of the ranch from year to year that you guys are paying attention to and things that you're keeping an eye on and things you're seeking to improve?
Boy, that's a great question. There's so many different ways that I could answer that. So we are a generational ranch, and our mission statement is a multi-generational family business that, with respect to land, water, wildlife, livestock, and people. So everything is looked at through that lens. Immediate short term, obviously, is making a profit. But making a profit to sustainably or regeneratively, we have ecological goals as well, which I feel like we're accomplishing by default because of what we're doing, basically. So it, in a way, the ecological goals almost aren't as big of a focus as where we are right now, is making sure that our animal performance is able to catch up, because where we are right now is our grazing management has far outpaced our genetics and our infrastructure. And so we have a very strong focus on getting our genetics dialed in, and we're chipping away at infrastructure projects, fence development, water development, in order to facilitate what kind of grazing practices that we need to do in order to make sure that this is a multi-generational family business and that we are able to pass this on to the sixth generation and the seventh generation. Mm. And so we're slowly chipping away at this bigger vision of ours of what we need to do and what we need to be and what tools we have to have and what kind of genetics that we have to have and what kind of a knowledge base we have to have and a community that we have to have in order to be successful generationally. Mm. But I would say the short-term focus, we're hitting that out of the park with our grazing management as far as what we're doing ecologically. Now it's catching our animal performance up. Part of that is this intense focus that we have on genetics and infrastructure development and continually renovating or regenerating. There's still some degraded ground here. Most, hay fields that we have that have been neglected for a couple decades, things like that.
You mentioned improving genetics. In what way do you see the genetics need to change to keep up with grazing management improvements?
Oh, I think the genetic resources we have in order to facilitate the type of grazing that needs to happen are pretty abysmal, really. Recently interviewed Gabe Brown, which is a great, great interview, and I think the world of Gabe, and he made the comment that 95% of the genetics that aren't what they need to be, that might even be on the low end. I don't even know if it's that low. I think the genetics, we've been selecting for the wrong genetics for too long, in my opinion, in the sense of what's actually able to have, as Zeitzman talks about, inherent body condition and a true range setting where truly adapted to their environment.
Right.
If you look at most of our breeds, most all of them are British influence, which is great for a lot of reasons. There's a lot of great traits that British breeds have, but they didn't evolve on, they came from areas that had, I don't know, what would it be, 9 month growing seasons? And then if you look at, say, breeds from Africa that evolved and where they had green grass 2 months out of the year, it's a totally different ball game, and they have an absolute unfair advantage over having that inherent body condition that's so absolutely necessary to be productive in a range setting, in a trying range setting. Mm. There's a study that an indigenous African breed, I don't know how you pronounce it, Nguni is what I'd say, N-G-U-N-I,
yep,
is able to recycle 3 times the amount of urea in their body than a Hereford. So there's a significant advantage from one breed to another. And so because of that, we're all in on composites and using composites to really mix and match for the right breed makeup, as well as to capture the heterosis effect. And the composites, the heterosis effect is if it's 5 or more breeds within one animal, that's an 83% to 88% heterosis effect maintained through generation. Whereas if it's just an F1 cross and it's 100%, that F1 calf has 100% heterosis effect, but its next calf will only have 50%, and that will keep getting diluted by half with each generation. So it's an amazing tool that I don't think is being used much or as much as it should be. And so we're all in on composites, and then we're trying to figure out what the right breed mix is for us, and then we're also raising our own bulls. About 50% of our bull battery are home raised, and in order to identify what bulls or we want. We kind of have a two-pronged approach. One is to go in and select bull calves out of our, what we call our mob, which would be the three-year-olds and up. But the criteria would be the cow has to be six years of age or older, slick calving in the first cycle, slick soft hair coat, body condition six or greater, moderate to smaller frame, great udder, good feet, good mothering instinct, and she just has to have a bull calf. I don't care what the bull calf looks like. And he gets a tag, and then we run him through our program. And then the second pronged approach, which is this is the part I'm most excited about because we're a commercial outfit. We really don't have much records on our cattle at all. And so we don't know what intercalving period is. We don't know, even though that 6-year-old or 10-year-old cow that we calved or we tagged the bull calf out of, there's no telling whether or not she has been calving in the first cycle and conceiving in the first cycle every year, or maybe that year that we tagged her calf was a fluke and that was the first time that she conceived in the first cycle in 7 years. So the second pronged approach is 30 days after our first calf heifers start to calve. So it'd be the end of June. We're calving 1st of June with our first calf heifers. End of June, we'll put in a bull or bulls of our choosing, and this is where our whole kind of genetic experiment comes in with starting to create our own composite. We'll put a bull in for a month, and then we'll pull them out at the end of July, first part of August, and then the rest of the bull battery doesn't go in until the end of August. There's a month gap there, and so what happens there is that bull picks up the elite of the elite. So the girls that conceived to him cycled first as yearlings, conceived first as yearlings, calved successfully, and then reconceived in a freakish amount of time. And then they calved 2 months earlier than everything else, and so we know that they calved out of those bulls, and they get a special tag, and we capture those genetics, and they're 9 times out of 10 cows you'd never be able to pick out, you know. But we capture those genetics and then cast them out over the rest of our herd. And hopefully, I'm really hoping we're starting to create a snowball effect to build in this genetic resiliency that we need in order for the type of grazing that needs to happen and to roll with these punches and with the challenging climatic conditions that we have, like the drought years, and you know, last winter was probably one of the worst winters that we've had. We need these cows to continue to maintain their body condition without much help from us, and still be productive in these really trying years. So we need that genetic resiliency built in. We have a weather station here on the ranch, and between 1980 and 2000, our average rainfall was 22.5 inches. And since 2000 to date, it's been 16. So that's a 6.5-inch rainfall difference, which you're talking two totally different environments. And in that same time frame, you know, input costs, I think across the whole agricultural sector has increased at least 40%, and our prices they've stayed relatively the same. And so we need this genetic buffer. This is why genetics are such a strong focus for us right now.
Right.
We need the animals to do more with less, just like how we need the extension of our grazing philosophy and grazing practice, setting up the ground to do more with less, and preparing every inch of ground to receive rainfall when it comes.
Yeah, I feel like I missed an opportunity due to a lack of clear communication, or probably more accurately, lack of communicating at a time when the individual I was communicating with was ready to hear what I was saying. And what I mean by that is my dad had this group of 10, 11, and 12-year-old cows that all looked the same. They got the same look, same body type, all these kinds of things, and they've just never missed. And I said, I want to buy all those cows that have a heifer calf at their side this year. And I would always comment on it when we were sorting. And so it wasn't something that I caught his attention well enough and said, I want to buy those cows, you know, because they just, it's kind of what I don't trust my eye because of things like you've said about the bulls that you're selecting, or things like Gabe Brown has said about the heifers that are proving themselves to be good fits for the environment. But when this group of cows just keeps getting bred and they all end up looking the same, I just want to buy that whole age group and keep their heifers
right.
and make them into cows, you know. But, and I think that another thing that I wanted to say is that Johann Zietzmann's texting group is an incredible opportunity of a free resource of constant flow of knowledge and paradigm challenges and different things like that. So if you aren't spending, I don't get to do it as often as I want to, but if you're not spending 15 minutes a day scrolling through that, you're probably shooting yourself in the foot. So if you want to get in touch with that group, I can help you out with that if you're interested. Show notes page for today's workingcows.net/125. A couple of things I want to talk to you about as we move towards wrapping up is with this composite that you're shooting to develop, are there going to be African influences, or is it just going to be a large different group of continental breeds? How do you feel about that? Because that's a question that I've had as I've scrolled through Johann's group, and I see people like Brian Harper in Manitoba who are creating a composite that they're using there. Is there going to be an African influence there for you guys, or is there another breed that has a short growing season and is able to thrive in it that you're looking at?
I am toying around with the idea of introducing Moshona on a small scale. I'd be very wary of having anything more than a quarter blood in our environment.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that they have a lot to offer. And what we've been introducing lately is Obrok. I bought an older Obrok bull. Obrok's a breed from south central France, and that's a region in France that's really cold climate, high altitude. I've heard that they can't even grow grains. And so this breed has been selected for their doability on grass for the last few hundred years. And they are impressive. They have very high inherent body condition. And so when we do that, we introduce it on a small scale. So that Obrok bull, he went out early on our calving first calf heifers. We got a few half bloods out of that, and then we have some half blood bulls that we then put in early to see what these quarter blood calves would be like, thinking that maybe quarter blood might be the end game for us. And that's the phase where we are right now. Is we've got probably 45 quarter blood calves on the ground right now that were born in June, and we're also unique in that we're part of an outfit called Country Natural Beef, where it's a rancher owned cooperative, and we retain ownership on all of our gap yearlings through the feedlot, and we get all the carcass data back, and so that'll be the end of that feedback loop. As far as whether or not those are genetics that we want to cast out over everything. So it's a very slow, cautious approach before we go and just start throwing genetics into the herd. We want to make sure it's actually adding to our genetic balance sheet, if you will. And the next thing that I play around with is Moshona. If I could get Drakensberger genetics, that's a breed from in South Africa from a colder mountainous climate from the, I think it's the Draken Mountains. I would be all about that, but I don't think that there's much Drakensberger outside of Africa, and you can't import semen from Africa, I've been told. And so Moshona would be the next thing that I'd look to see what kind of an influence I could have and whether or not it could move our genetics in the right direction.
Sure. Could you talk briefly about some of your trips to other continents and countries and some of the things you've learned and how you've implemented them there at Sieben Livestock?
Yeah, so after graduating from college, I spent 4 years traveling around, working on ranches around the world. I worked on two ranches in northern Mexico, ranch in Colorado for 2 years, and then a ranch down in Patagonia, southern Patagonia, and northern Argentina, and two large cattle stations in Australia, northern Australia. And I learned an amazing amount from each one, and each one had so much to offer. Both ranches in Mexico had phenomenal stories, and really a testament to what holistic management and proper grazing practices can do, especially in a brittle environment. I mean, it's just absolutely astounding. The first ranch called Valle Colombia, which is owned by the Bermudez family, currently managed by Tavo Bermudez, who he'd be an interesting one for you to talk to, but I was picked up from the bus station in the nearest town, which was 5 hours away, by two of their hired hands, and they had this stock truck that they picked me up in, this Mercedes stock truck, and we're driving along, and it was getting dark, and we're driving up in the mountains, and all I could see was what was in the headlights, and it was just rocks and dirt, cactus, and some brush every now and then. And then we went through a gate, went through another gate, and immediately the grass was as tall as the headlights in that stock truck. And the driver turned to me and he said, "Welcome to the ranch." So that was my introduction to Valle Colombia, which is in Coahuila, one of the northern states in Mexico. And then the second place was in Sonora, Ivan Aguirre's place, and which just has an absolutely amazing story to it. They're doing really cool things down there. The place in Patagonia was a big sheep ranch and had some cattle, and they were just implementing some holistic management. We're going through those challenges, but that was fascinating. That was like a step back in time. That's like Montana in the 1800s is what it seemed like, and I just got to, I was just a gaucho going out. You just go out on horseback every day. You tie a leg of lamb onto the back of your saddle, and another guy would tie a burlap sack filled with rolls that they would have cooked in sheep lard, and just go out. When it's time for lunch, you light a fire and you cook that meat over the fire and eat it with your rolls. And about every 3-4 days, we'd kill a ewe. And that's just, it was just mutton and sweet potatoes and just. And then the northern Argentina was a place where it was 75,000 acres, and 70,000 acres of that were islands in the middle of the Paraná River. And so I worked on it as a deckhand on a cattle boat for a few weeks, just shuffling cattle back and forth between these islands. And I worked on as a gaucho on some of these islands. And same deal, it was off the grid. They didn't have any refrigeration, and so they had all these yard geese and ducks. So when you get back from work, you'd go catch a duck or a goose, and you'd slaughter it, and you'd have an asado, and that's what you had for dinner. And then Australia was just, it was pretty amazing. Wild cattle, really neat people. What the Australians have figured out, and that was just in northern Queensland, so I can't speak for, I had a very narrow lens into what Australian agriculture is like. There are these huge stations in the Delta country, and, you know, they have the wet season and the dry season, and the wet season before they had a really bad flood and they had to ride off like 1,600 cattle as being washed out to sea. Huh. You'd be riding along and you'd see these cow carcasses like 10 feet up in tree branches.
Oh, wow.
But I was part of a muster crew where we'd camp out in the bush, and just, you know, the pastures were anywhere from 30,000 to 150,000 acres. We have a helicopter pilot. There are 7 of us on the ground, either on bikes or horseback, and you gather the pasture into the yard. And what Australians are so good at is their, at least where I was just so impressed with their ingenuity. The yards that they are designing are so efficient. Their corral system is so efficient. You know, we bring these groups in, and I'd have to look back at my notes, but there was one day there was 4 of us, and we sorted, let's see, it was like 2,500 or 3,000 head that we sorted 5 ways and processed in 5 hours with 4 of us.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, it was, you wear running shoes when you're working cattle in the yard, because you're just moving all the time, and also, you know, there are these wild Brahma cattle that you have to wear running shoes, and you have to get good at dodging them, otherwise you'll end up in the hospital kind of deal. So.
Big and athletic, those cows are.
Yeah. Oh, they're amazing.
Yeah.
They're just so fun to work. They're so sensitive. Yeah. They're really, I was just being, you know, I'd been exposed to Bud Williams for quite some time and was really diving into it. And, you know, I was, you know, not many people on the same page that I was working with, but what was so fun was being the guy. I loved being the guy in the back by myself, just staging cattle, because if they were just so if they were in the right mind frame, you know, sometimes they could be fairly blitzed from being run in or brought in. But if they're in the right mind frame, they were so fun and enjoyable to work.
Cool. And did any of these opportunities in other countries and continents facilitate change at Sieben Livestock over the years, or how have you continued to benefit from those experiences?
Yeah, I think it did. Nothing concretely, but it worked. What all of those experiences did to me was, and why I searched them out in the first place, was I'd only ever worked for my family, you know, and in this environment. And I knew that I had a finite time, that I had four years until I had to come back home and start phasing in for the generational transfer. And so what I wanted to do was to keep my learning curve as deep and as fast as possible, and big believer in putting yourself outside of your comfort zone. And so I wanted to go around to different environments and different cultures, different languages, and just keep myself on a very steep learning curve. And I think what that allowed me to do was be observant and really study things and try and connect dots on what you see on the ground and season after season, and trying to deduce what the common denominators are and really truly learn from it, and always just be asking why. I think that's the biggest thing I got from those experiences, was just being open-minded, being willing to be outside of my comfort zone, and realize that, you know, there's always a better way to do things.
Very cool. Yeah, one of the big things I've learned through this podcast is that the places that you think you know in the world because you saw a postcard once are no indication of the rest of that portion of the world, that so much of the world is so much more diverse than we think it is. You know, the postcard tends to make you think you know what you're getting into, but you talk to a guy from China who is actually borders on a swamp, and he's, you know, so it just continues to blow my mind. So anyways, thank you for your time. Thank you for your generosity with your time today. I really appreciate it. There's many more episodes have come out of this one. And after I scrolled through all of the GIFs and all of the memes on Logan Pribineau's timeline, I got to this tweet. He said, "I spent the last few days in good company on a well-managed sea of grass," and that is Sieben Livestock. So really appreciate what you guys are doing there to improve the land with the cows, and hope we can connect again sometime for some further discussion.
Thank you, Clay. I appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, some really exciting stuff coming up for the Working Cows podcast. I'm really excited about opportunities to share with you some episodes I recorded while here in Canada. Also excited about next week's episode. We're going to talk to Craig Guffey of Swear Engine Angus. A really neat opportunity there, talking about just good genetics, and really look forward to sharing that episode with you. Probably going to challenge some paradigms of the paradigm challengers. So I'm always down for that too. So then also, like I said, 127 will be with Steve Kenyon. We talked about being lifelong learners, and then episode 128 will be kind of a review of Holistic Management Canada Conference, and I'll share with you the talk that I gave there at Holistic Management Canada. So really looking forward to just what's coming up. I've got some other exciting episodes that I recorded while I was up here, and stuff to share with you from that. So looking forward to the near future here on the Working Cows podcast. We'll see you real soon with another episode.
We invite you to visit workingcows.net to subscribe to the show via iTunes or Stitcher. You'll also find detailed show notes pages, resources from our guests, and the industry leaders who have influenced them. For more ideas on putting your cows to work for you in a more profitable way, tune in next week.